physical technical institute in St. Petersburg. Dean Reimers from Hamburg University, and Sergei Korsak from my home institution, the Nuclear Physics Institute, and Paolo Malara from Trieste. And the second part of my talk will be devoted to some new things which again were mentioned yesterday. And they are not yet published. It was supposed that Sergei Ryshakov will discuss them here. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to come, so I will try to give you some understanding of what we did there. Okay, let's first start with a list of the fundamental constants we are actually discussing in atomic and molecular physics. We can check, of course, fine structure constant, which is relevant to everything in electromagnetism. Then proton to electron mass ratio give you kind of comparison of the scales of electromagnetic and strong interactions. And nuclear geomagnetic ratio, GM, which in principle can be, it's probably not as fundamental as two other constants, but for our purposes, it is more or less independent because we don't know how to link it to accurately to more fundamental things. So in atomic physics, we have these three constants, which define different scales in atomic and molecular spectrum. So yesterday we had a comprehensive discussion of optical observations in astrophysics. So I'm not stopping on that. And of course, this is also well known for this audience. The important thing I want to dwell about a little bit is the bandwidth in astrophysics is basically determined by Doppler shift in most cases. So that means that the ratio of gamma to omega depends on the velocity distribution in a particular molecular cloud, whatever you are observing there, divided by speed of light. That means that this ratio is independent on the band where you observe your spectra, whether it's ultraviolet or microwave. And typical for extragalactic spectra, I think the typical value is something like 10 to minus 5 for this ratio, which corresponds to velocity distribution in the range from 1 to 10 kilometers per second. That means that this ratio basically gives you the scale of the accuracy you can achieve in astrophysical spectra. Of course, if you have very nice strong lines with good statistics, you can go within the line width, but maybe by one order of magnitude, not much more. So this is the parameter which gives you the accuracy of your observations, of a single observation. As we said yesterday, then you can get statistics by observing many different lines from many different objects. And this way you can get another order of magnitude or so from this kind of average. Anyway, as long as this ratio is more or less fixed and independent on the frequency, it is more convenient to talk about these dimensionless coefficients which define the sensitivity of a particular transition to the variation of constants. So you can write this equation with all three relevant constants here. Coefficients k are dimensionless, and k alpha is related to the q factor, which was used yesterday, just in the form that k alpha times omega divided by 2 is equal to Q factor. But I stress once again that it's more convenient to use this dimensionless coefficient because it is related to this sensitivity which you have. So even if you have lines with high sensitivity with large K coefficients, it's not sufficient because you have to distinguish these shifts which come from cardinal constants with the red shift from the general expansion of the universe and also from Doppler shifts which may be there. So you actually compare the apparent red shifts of at least two transitions, and if these transitions have different sensitivities, then this apparent difference in the redshift, supposedly, if you assume that actual redshift is the same, so the lines come from the same object and the species are co-distributed in space, then this apparent difference in the redshift can be related to the variation of constants via this expression with delta k's being differences of the sensitivity coefficients of these two lines. And again, you of course don't know from one measurement which constant is changing. So you can rewrite this right-hand side in terms of a single synthetic parameter f, which can be written in this form. So if one of these delta k's is much bigger than others, then you are actually measuring variation of one constant. Otherwise, you are measuring the variation of the combination. And this is the table which gives you some sense of what kind of sensitivity you have in different ranges. And in optical and UV range, which was mostly discussed yesterday, typical sensitivity to alpha variation is of the order of 10 to minus 2, both for atoms and molecules. In some extreme cases, for the most heavy atoms, it can approach something like 10 to minus 1. But even for iron, it's 10 to minus 2.
For astrophysics,
yeah, yes. In laboratory, it may be close to
bigger. You don't know dysprosium in astrophysics,
yeah.
Was observed.
No.
Yeah, yes. In laboratory, the situation is different. And also in laboratory, it's not always convenient to use these dimensionless coefficients because there, the line width is not Doppler dominated usually. Mm-hmm. It's natural line width, which is independent on the frequency. If you use highly forbidden transitions, you can have very narrow lines, even with very high frequency. So this is something which is relevant to astrophysics. Today I'm fixed to astrophysics. I'm not discussing
more. When you say 10 to minus 5 for the Maxwellian distribution, you mean heavy elements or...?
It's not... in astrophysics, again, it's usually not Maxwellian distribution. It's turbulent motion. But it is kind of... as I said, it corresponds to velocities like 1 to 10 kilometers. So it's not temperature distributions usually. It's just large object which has internal motions. Okay, so this is what you have in optical and UV range. And you see that all coefficients are small. In particular, this is extremely small because it's just it comes through the high-profile structure. But K mu is also small. In atoms, it's just isotope shifts. In molecules, you have rotational and vibrational structures, so it's larger. But if you are stuck to UV range, it's also small. In microwave, situation is very different. For example, you can have fine structure transition between levels of the ground state multiplier. In astrophysics, you usually have transitions from the ground state. So. And of course, the splittings of the fine structure are proportional to alpha squared, so the coefficient is 2, and it basically practically depends on two other parameters. Then we have vibrational transitions, which are proportional to the square root of inverse mass ratio. I'm using the large mean, which is MP divided by ME. So it's minus one half here. For rotational transition, it's minus 1. Then, for any hyperfine transition, of course, but in astrophysics, it's usually hydrogen hyperfine line. It's 2 here, minus 1, and 1 here. And this is the only transition which has large sensitivity to GPEG. Then there are more exotic cases, like 18 centimeter lambda doublet line in OH. And this lambda splitting appears in the high orders of Bohr-Oppenheimer approximation. So it is proportional to the complex combination. In the lowest order, the coefficients here are minus 2, minus 3. And there is hyperfine substructure of this line, which is about 10% of the line frequency, so there is some sensitivity to G factor. Finally, there is this inversion line in ammonia, which appears due to the tunneling, so it is extremely sensitive to the reduced mass of this particular vibrational mode. So it is extremely sensitive to the mass ratio. Okay, so you see that in a microwave and infrared bands, we have coefficients which are of the order of unity and roughly two orders of magnitude bigger than in optics and UV ranges. So I think I mostly said this. I may mention that this OH line was studied by Kanikara and co-authors, and they realized that it has this high sensitivity to alpha and mu. I will mention the result later on. And of course, the fact that ammonia is sensitive to variation of mu was understood by molecular physicists, I think, in general, but in particular, one of the authors mentioned it in one of their papers. But they probably didn't know that ammonia is observed in astrophysics. I don't know. I think he was co-author of the first paper as well. No? Okay. Maybe not. Now I switch to the limits which you can get from observations in microwave region, and I want to mention the paper of Borshalovich and Patekin in 1996, where they had transventions of rotational and optical lines for the object with redshift about 2, and got this limit on mu. Then later on, Murphy and co-authors compared 21 centimeter hydrogen line with rotational lines of several molecules for this very famous object in astrophysics. This is gravitational lens, which was studied in big detail in many bands, including microwave. So they got this limit on the combination alpha squared GN, because of course this 21 centimeter is sensitive to this combination. Now, Kanikara and co-authors studied for each line for the same object, Z.7, and got this limit.
Okay, is this pi?
No, it's not pi.
And that is pi divided by 2.
As I said, in the lowest order, you get 3 here and I think 2 here, but when you include higher order corrections, you get these fractional powers form for this all each transition. Okay, so you see that OH is, of course, very sensitive to this combination. You get strong limit from there. And again, the reference was rotational lines of some simple molecules. And finally, last year, we used NH inversion line for the same object to get this limit on mu. And again, the reference was rotation. So the last three limits are obtained for the same object. So you see that we actually have, in principle, a complete experiment. We have three limits.
I have a question about the OH. You said the reference was another molecule. I thought the point of OH was that there were a couple lines that shifted differently, so you could, the reference could be the OH itself.
In principle, yes. There are two ways how to do this. First, you have a hyperfine structure. You actually have four transitions instead of one. But then you have to take combination. The difference, the hyperfine interval related to this OH interval, right? So you have combination omega 1 minus omega 2 divided by omega 1 plus omega 1. And this ratio is small, as I said, about 10%. But your line width is the same. So the numerator of this ratio is not well defined, right? So you lose about an order of magnitude in your sensitivity if you do this this way. So instead of that, they used rotational lines of different molecules. Because unfortunately, rotational lines of OH were not observed. It would be better to compare to rotational transitions of the same OH molecule.
I thought it was that what you just talked about is when they use the main lines to get by the doublet. But I thought if you had the satellite lines, you could actually recover the sensitivity.
That's what is done in
I don't think you can recover the satellite lines. Sorry?
In Beneker et al., they detected the satellite lines as this way.
They discussed this, but in fact, if you look how this comes about, it comes from comparison to rotation, because otherwise you lose about an order of magnitude. That was their idea. They discussed it, but the actual limit comes. I'm pretty much sure that you can check. Anyway, we as you see, we have a complete experiment, which was, unfortunately, the analysis was done independently for these three pairs. You take hydrogen, you relate it to rotation, you take OH related basically to the same rotational lines, you take ammonia and use the same reference. So it would be better to reanalyze this whole set of data simultaneously to exclude. I think this way you can improve these limits a little bit. Anyway, you can resolve these three equations and come up with these limits. And of course, I forgot to mention that this limit from ammonia was recently improved by Murphy and Coles by more accurate analysis and using better rotational steps. Okay, anyway, I think this object still has a potential. So if all lines are remeasured with higher statistics, I would strongly recommend to make a complete analysis of all the available data to get this kind of complete experiment. Now I switch to fine structure lines, which are observed for extremely higher redshifts in astrophysics. These lines are observed in emission, and data for redshifts of 6.4 and 4.7, where this fine structure line was seen, and also the CO rotational line was seen. So in a similar way, you can use this to get limits on the combination alpha squared mu, which was done this year by the Shakov and Kohl system. So in principle, you can go even farther to redshifts of the order of 10. So this way you can study very early epochs of the evolution of the universe. Already this corresponds to something like 93% of the lifetime of the universe. Though the limits are weaker because the lines are typically much broader there. I think it's the line that is about 30 kilometers. It would be preferable to use the same species to compare the lines of the same species to exclude systematics from different distributions of different species in this molecular cloud, which can produce additional Doppler nodes and systematics. Right. So as I mentioned, you can do this by, for example, observing rotational and inversion line in ammonia. In principle, rotational lines are also seen in astrophysics, so it is possible. The same thing for OH. You can observe this 18 centimeter line and rotational line to avoid this additional systematic error. It seems that you cannot use fine structure lines of atomic ions because, as I said, they have sensitivity to alpha equal to 2. So if you have several transitions for the same multiplet, they are all they have the same sensitivity, so the difference is 0. But it's not exactly the same. It was discussed by Zuber and Flambaum in relation to atomic laboratory experiments, where you can go again to very high nuclear charges, very high elements, where high order relativistic corrections are important, so the difference may be really huge. In fact, it can
what
be.
What does it mean here? I think the.
Like mercury.
The most accurate. Okay. Well, the most accurate was measured fine structure in magnesium.
Magnesium is not sufficient.
I'm not sure that anybody can see the fine structure of
mercury. Zuber and Flambaum discussed some exotic, really
okay.
heavy
okay.
elements with d electrons, I think.
It's interesting that in not very heavy elements, like nickel, for example, there is hydrogen linear caps also.
Yeah,
there is no enhancement, but the dependence is very high in
yeah.
linear because, you're just showing.
Yeah, so that's what you need.
It's not necessary to go to heavy
right,
elements,
right.
enough to have dense spec.
Yeah, but it's kind of exotic. Yeah, you need dense spec. What you have here, this is the multiplet, and the sensitivity equal to 2 comes from this linear part of the spectrum. When either you change alpha in your calculation, but of course nature has alpha very close to 137 minus 1. So instead of changing alpha, you can go from light elements to heavy elements with the same configuration, so the structure of terms is similar. And it corresponds to shifting from left to the right of this block. So here, sensitivities are exactly equal to 2, but when you go to the right, this lower term start to interact with this singlet sigma, and interaction is caused the increase of the slope of this term, and this one interacts with this term. Well, to the first approximation, there is no term here to, for this guy to interact with. So this remains unperturbed, while these two start to deviate from lambda rule, which governs the behavior here. So this slope becomes smaller and sensitivity is less than 2, and this becomes bigger, so sensitivity is bigger than 2, so you gain some difference. And you can, in the first approximation, do it analytically and relate the difference to the violation of the lambda rule. So when the lambda rule is fulfilled, this square bracket is 0, so the difference in sensitivity is 0. But when it deviates from 0, you get some non-zero result. So this is an analytical simple expression which involves only measured frequency. But you can do it also more accurately. And here are the results. For light elements like carbon and oxygen, the difference is small, but it's still of the same order as you have in optics, n minus 2. It's even bigger here. And then it grows. For iron, you have a multiple with many lines. So J changes from 4 to 0. So we have many transitions there with different sensitivities. So you can use it to suppress some systematics. You don't need to look this off, but you see that for magnesium 5 and calcium 5, the difference is already of the order of unit. So if you go to higher and highly excited ions, you can have enhanced sensitivity. Okay.
But in mythology, it was no measurements even with doubly charged ions.
Right, but you don't need here a laboratory as a reference, which is important. I think.
Do you know?
No, you should. Vis-a-vis, no.
You do. I think you do.
Yeah. Probably you do. Okay.
But because your measurement sensitivity is lower, yeah. The lines are broader. That is laboratory measurement.
Yeah, yeah. So for highly charged ions, yeah. Of course, you need the reference, laboratory reference. Sure. But the frequencies are known, maybe not with very high accuracy. Okay, I don't think I need to stop once again on the conclusions for this part. I already said all this. And now I want to switch to this second topic, to the measurements of ammonia lines in our galaxy for zero redshifts. And here, Sergei Lyubchakov found out that there are very high-precision spectra for several molecular clouds in our galaxy. The most complete that exists for Perseus cloud. Then there is the Spike Nebula, and these are mostly to scale here. This is the direction to the center of the galaxy. And there is another more distant object or several objects which are known as infrared dark clouds in general direction of this thick line. And for all of them, there are very accurate ammonia spectra with a typical line width of the order of 100 meters instead of kilometers per second, as for extragalactic objects. And there are also measurements of rotational spectra of several molecules. So you can do the same thing as for extragalactic objects, but with a significantly higher sensitivity. And also, here you have spatial resolution for this cloud, and these lines are observed in emission here. So you can measure spectra from different parts of the cloud. So for Perseus, for example, there were more than 100 different points where measurements were done by Rozalovsky and co-authors. But for 98 points, they were simultaneously measured ammonia spectra and rotational spectra. In this case, it was CCS transition. Okay, so on this plot, we show the line width of ammonia line versus the line width of CCS rotational line. And you see that the quality of these lines vary quite a bit. There are narrow lines, which are on this part of the plot. There are wide lines here. There are also weak lines, as you can see with large arrow bars here, and stronger lines. So not all of them are equally useful. By excluding the weak and wide lines, also multi-component lines, where you probably have several objects on your line of sight.
Uncertainty in velocity dispersion. So the shape of line is complicated. And
yeah, sometimes for some of these wide lines, the shape is not simple. It has double or triple maximum, so on. So when you exclude these, you end up with 34 strong and narrow lines. And now you can apply additional check by requiring that the line width, ammonia line width, and CCS line correspond to the same distribution, velocity distribution. If it's turbulent distribution, then you expect the same line width. If it's thermal distribution, you expect ammonia to be slightly wider. So the line, the width should lie in this curve.
Yeah, but so one more question about uncertainty in velocity dispersion. So the shape of line is complex. So how it is interpreted? So you have overlap of few lines, because if shape of line is trivial, you can expect that it is a simple source,
right.
And it's the same for two molecules. If you think that overlap means that you observe two or three different sources,
yeah, probably,
and you can have different abundance, and that means that average value is not the same. So you see, let's say, the same C overlapping peaks, but with different amplitudes, and that means that they should not agree very well.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why we excluded them from our consideration. Also, for example, this point, which looks nice, but the line width here is bigger than here. So it's possible that you observe ammonia from one part, and this they just lie on one line of sight, but they are not specially co-distributed. Mm. So we excluded these as well from our analysis. We end up with somehow 20. Points.
How many points you exclude?
So, 98. All in all, there were 98. Now, we excluded this complex. We end up with 34, which are here. And now we are plotting here the offset, the difference in observed velocity for CCS and NH3. So zero corresponds to the same redshift, and non-zero effect is what we are looking for. So you see that for this subset of 34 points, most of them lie above the zero line. Right? For the subset of 21, which meets our requirement of the comparable line width, it's still similar with some non-zero shift. And the scale here, this is 100 meters per second, so you can see with your eye that it's something like 50 meters per second, the offset.
But if you excluded so many points, how do you estimate probabilities at some point just accidentally lies the correct interval?
Right.
Do you estimate this probability?
Yeah, well, I'll show you the final table and we'll return to this. Okay, so now this is the second object, Pike Nebula. The reference rotational molecule is again CCS. Here, unfortunately, the published data do not have the arrow bars for the line widths, but it's the same plot, the cone, and then these 8 points here are plotted here for the offset. And you see again, it's the average is somewhere near 50. it's definitely positive. This is the third object, infrared dark clouds, number of objects. And here the rotational spectrum was for a different molecule. It's NNH plus. Again, you see that there is some positive offset. Maybe here it is slightly bigger here, of the order of 100 or 150 meters. This is subset, again, which meets our criterion on the limit, and the offset is still positive. For the same objects, they also observed rotational transition for this HC3N mode. So we have additional information by comparing these two guys. Again, the data shows some positive offset. Finally, you can compare these two rotational lines to see that this effect comes from ammonia. And here you see that the spread is equally positive and negative. So this is the final table. For Perseus, we have the combination of MHP and CCS. And this is the whole. Nothing is excluded here. All 98. And this is the standard root mean square analysis. This is robust M estimates. You see that for the, I will use this, it's slightly more stable. So you see that the whole set of data gives us the offset of 40 meters. Then 34 single profile strong lines give us 45. The final subset give us 52. So the difference is not huge here. Again, the Pipe Nebula, we have only 12 points here. 8 of them agrees with our requirements. And here the difference is a little bigger, but still within the error bars. For infrared dark clouds, we have these three combinations. And again, this is the whole array of data. This is a subset which we choose, but the offset is the same, though it's bigger than for those objects, and the other ones are bigger. Now, another molecule here gives us slightly smaller offset, and two rotational lines of these two molecules don't have any significant offset in respect to each other. So this is what we get, actually. We used the published data from the literature. We contacted the authors and discussed the possible systematics. So, and Rozalovsky, the author, the first author of this observation in Perseus Nebula, actually reanalyzed his data on our request once again. And he reproduced almost all, I think, in two cases from these 82, 88. The new data were more than one sigma deviated from what they originally published. So at the moment, we don't see any systematics in this. And this is the final result in terms of this velocity offset for Perseus, for Pipe, and for two different rotational references for infrared dark clouds. Systematics here correspond to the accuracy to which we know laboratory frequencies. I'm already 5 minutes late. I'm finished. Right, you'll see. So you see that in principle here, the main error comes from the accuracy to which we know this CCS rotational transition.
You put a statistical on the other
Yeah, so this is...
But this is one on the square root of the number of points times the RMS of the points, right? You see an enormous scatter between points.
This is actually...
If you go back to your plots with the actual velocity, yeah, these plots here, you see a huge scatter between points. And I think in this case, it would be very interesting to see the spectra, because these are huge differences. You should be able to see those with your eye.
Yeah, the spectra are available.
Sure, but I think in this case it would be easy to see it on the graph. This is not an indication.
I don't have a theory, but except maybe for these two points, it doesn't look so bad.
If it's typically more than one sigma, it means chi squared is very bad.
This scatter could be indicating real.
Still, one of the questions is, since you dismiss many lines.
We didn't. If you like, use these upper lines here, which include the whole array. Use this if you don't trust us.
Reason for selection was right. That you believe that most of the lines may be accidental overlap.
Right.
In this case, if lines meet proper criteria, but probability of overlap is large, maybe some of them still meeting criteria are accidental and not related to the
sure.
And it may be, let's say, half of lines which you interpret. So that means that you should have, let's say, model, systematical model on sortancy, because in your case, probability of overlap of two different sources is relatively large.
Right.
In principle, that's why they do statistics.
This may be the reason for this spread.
These are emission lines, right? So it's a very different case to absorption lines. And you can have emission from the skin of a cloud in one species and from the bulk of the cloud in another. And that's particularly the case when you're looking at comparison with ammonia, which will occur in the bulk. CCS will occur on the skin. It's natural then you have these.
Right.
You can check your evaluation how it depends if you randomly dismiss half of points.
I think that's
if they accidentally overlap. And just see what is the distribution to model. And that would add an additional uncertainty for a possible overlap of the data.
Right. I think it's still more or less clear, even from these data, that most of the points lie above this line, right? So whatever you do, and also,
as I showed,
these final results not significantly depend on whether you choose something or you use the whole.
It's an interesting point is if you look at the sigma RMS, and it seems to come down the scatter. Whereas your final error has no sensitivity.
Yeah, because this is what is called a robust M estimate. It actually it excludes, say, roughly speaking, you exclude 10% of the data from the upper side and 10% of the data on the lower side, and you calculate the result. Then you exclude 15%, and you see how things change.
Is the skin effects. That could give you, that's a directional effect, so that on every line of sight you will see systematically a problem. So yes, there's a scatter, it will contribute to that, but there will be a systematic as well.
Yeah, we tried to analyze this. I think these clouds are optically thin, so you should see both skin.
No, the important point, another important point here is that what is the beam of your radio observations? Because not only you are worried about skin, in absorption studies you are probing through a point, literally. Here it's a beam, and you are observing two objects in two frequencies. If you observe with the same antenna, the beams are going to be different.
Beams are slightly.
For example, for a given beam, not only you mix up material with the skin, like what Michael is saying, in addition to that, you are mixing up in the volume. So it is very sensitive to issues. So
I agree. These are problems.
I will be very careful if you actually reanalysis would take into account the fact that the beam effects. As well as maybe somebody should model and see that what is the segregation in the photo dislocation regions of these nebula.
Yeah,
That, it's very complicated physics. In
that's right. So at this point, we are not pushing this result as to say that we really observed.
Can you go back? What's this minus 15? Is this a line or what's minus?
No, it's between minus 5 and minus 15.
That's what
if you just the 15 corresponds to these larger sets and 5 corresponds to the sign is the same everywhere. So. Right, so I agree that systematics has to be studied more accurately, and that this is what we are now trying to push. We want to try to do new observations, and we are in contact with the groups who did these observations. So I hope we will have more on this in the near future. But anyway, I think it's an interesting thing to discuss. It also it may be important for the extragalactic observations, because here we are talking about ships which are about two orders of magnitude smaller. So by studying this in emission, yeah, by studying this you can learn something about spectra there and possible systematics there. Because these molecular clouds are not so much different, I think, now and the redshift about...
Naively, that's a correct statement, but it's a big difference between emission and absorption. You can't just say, well,
yeah,
you see systematics at this level here, therefore you should see the same in absorption. That is a very big stretch.
Could you tell me what is the source for initial energy? It's from collision or from some ray?
It's further dissociation energy, as Richard says.
It's various things, for example, UV pumping.
It just means that in principle, the energy could be also shifted because you don't have, in a sense, free molecules. In absorption, you have a bigger chance that energy is unperturbed.
I don't think that's the main
point. It's a difference between foreign source and spreaded source, because my understanding for emissions may come from anywhere, from absorption. It's
but
technically
still, do you need interaction to create emission?
Yeah, but
it's a collision energy.
Yeah, so emission may be from a much broader area.
Yeah, but I ask another question. So whether emissions need some interaction in order to get energy, and if it needs some
interaction
and collision, it could shift the line. So
you know, this happens even in absorption. That's what absorption is saying.
And again, to finish this, I want to say that it will be extremely interesting to observe rotational lines of ammonia. Together with this inversion line. Rotational spectra were seen in our galaxy, so it should be possible. This is one of the possible lines to proceed. Okay, so that's all I wanted to talk. Thank you.
Do you have questions?
Just a quick question, sorry, I don't have much. Like, what sort of look back time is this, and how does this compare with what?
Yes, this is a very short look back time from 400 years for the closest five nebula to something like 10,000 years for this infrared dark clouds. As I said, this last object is actually.
You showed the time dark measurements would be constrained much below this, right?
Yeah, so this is what I forgot. Thank you for reminding me. If we take this seriously, the non-zero result, just let's assume that there is something there. What it can be? It cannot be time variation because it well off from both laboratory and this high redshift. This is too many orders of magnitude larger. If you try to link this to gravitational potential, it again doesn't work from the laboratory measurements because, as it was mentioned yesterday, this 3% or whatever difference in gravitational potential in the laboratory measurements is sufficient to again to put a limit which is much stronger than what we have here. So the most intriguing are these chameleon type models which link the shift to the local density. And all these clouds have similar very low density compared to the vacuum which you have here in the lab. So this is this may be the thing. So this kind of
so the density in the clouds is lower than in the vacuum.
It's much lower. Yes. It's something like 10^4, 10^5.
It doesn't even matter in the lab. What you know, it's not just the purity of the vacuum, but the size of your chamber.
And size of
you can have a vacuum zero, no particles at all. But if the chamber has a finite size, you don't restore the same value of the field as you have somewhere where you have a large amount, you know,
so
area
of
sure, you're welcome.
It may be escalated.
Yeah, you can, but
escalator independence.
Okay, but here again, you have three different directions in space. You have very different types. It doesn't look like escalation, more like density dependence, which is, the density is similar. And of course, we didn't know this paper by Maxim and Olive, and we found it later on, and we were excited that it can be a possible explanation for this.
So if that's it, we need to call for next speaker.